If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
This episode is brought to you by PwC. When unprecedented times are all the time, it's time to start walking the talk. Leaders like you turn to PwC to see and stay ahead. Upskill your workforce, use intelligent automation, and transform big ideas into breakthrough reinvention. Explore the human-led, tech-powered solutions that help you reinvent. It's all part of the new equation. Learn more at pwc.com.
The XX GabFest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Welcome to the XX GabFest for Thursday, September 19th, the Pajama Party Edition. We are doing a special live show at the Center for Study of Gender and Conflict at George Mason University. How do we know that we're doing a live show? Here's your moment. Thank you. I'm Hannah Rosen from XX. I am joined on the stage today by, on my right, Noreen Malone from The New Republic. Hi, Noreen.
Hey, Hannah.
And Dan Coyce, culture editor at Slate. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
So you guys don't know that we had a Slate retreat this weekend in which there was lots of shouting and dancing. And Dan Coyce is not only a master DJ, but also a master karaoke and singer of all kinds. And so he has lost his voice, and his voice has become much more sexy and appealing.
It's a lot more Johnny Cashy.
So you will get to benefit from that. Okay, our three topics for today. First, we are going to talk about Pax Dickinson, who is a tech executive who said lots of jerky things on Twitter and got in a lot of trouble, but caused us all to think about sexism in the tech industry. Our second topic is rape in the military. There are lots of proposals floating around in Congress to deal with sexual assault and essentially re-engineer the military. So we're going to talk about which of those we like and what that means. And our final topic is going to be pajama chic. There's a new trend both on the runways and in college campuses and among high school kids to wear pajamas during the day. I tried to get these guys to wear pajamas during the day. Some of them refused and others of them consented. And you will find out which is which when we get to our pajama segment.
Consented.
Eagerly and enthusiastically, and others didn't want to. I wanted to wear pajamas, but then the rest of us split. Okay, let's go to Pax Dickinson. Last week, a site that covers the tech industry discovered the Twitter feed of a little-known chief technology officer of Business Insider named Pax Dickinson. What a great name for someone to rise up in the news for a week. I'm going to read you one of the charming tidbits. If you're interested, you can go on his Twitter feed yourself and read the rest of the charming tidbits. But here is just one. Who has more dedication, ambition, and drive? Kobe only raped one girl. LeBron raped an entire city. Plus one for LeBron. Anyway, it goes on and on and on like that. His friend came back explaining that Pax was not really a jerk. He was just pretending to be a jerk. He said that he was a frequently hilarious performance artist who tweets with a faux programmer alter ego. Mm-hmm. For many years. And then Pax came back saying that the tech world doesn't have a woman problem, just that there aren't many women because tech is just a kind of thing that a lot of women aren't that interested in. So, this is where it gets interesting. We don't actually care that much about Pax Dickinson. I'm sure you will all forget his name within a few days. But here's what we do care about. First, this character, this new American character called the Tech Bro, has emerged in our culture. So, Dan, do you want to talk about, since you are a tech bro?
You work for a website. You're a man. You must be a tech
bro.
You're
a man. You work in an online company.
Let me put on my aviators.
Put on your glasses, just like Pax Dickinson. Who is the tech bro? Why do we care about the tech bro? We'll get to why we care. Let's just describe what the tech bro is.
View the tech bro in his native environment. Well, so, you know, the tech industry is chock full of people who have this very sort of, like, Ayn Randian view of the world, right? That merit always rises to the top, and that is why, of course, they have risen to the top. And you can measure merit very easily by how much code you can crunch in 24 hours or how much funding you get or whatever. And so I think especially at the upper levels of the tech world, there is this sort of amazing tradition of just guys who are so unbelievably self-confident, which in the actual normal human world can often translate into like really gross bro-ishness.
Mm-hmm. But in the tech world, it translates to lots
it translates
of money.
To money, yes, right. Yes, to filthy lucre.
And tech bros are interested in different things than bro bros sometimes, right? Like there's
right.
a specific tech subculture, and here I'm going to really broadly stereotype, so get ready. You know, they might be more into like talking about their sweet hike last weekend than like their sweet Lamborghini or something, but it is still a specific, like it's a majority male environment, and so it's like they're reinforcing behaviors at each other.
Right. Well, and so in the great piece about it that came out last week was Ann Friedman in New York Magazine talking about the notion that what makes a bro is his bros, right? The fact that a bro alone is not bro.
So you on the stage.
Right. No, I'm the anti-bro.
Right.
Yeah. No, but just that it's that pack behavior reinforces the not only your sort of a derisive view of women, but also your amazing view of yourself, because everyone around you is like slapping you on the back, bro.
Yeah, bro. But we haven't talked about the bro's view of women, because is it derisive? Is it indifferent? Is it clueless? I think the bro's relationship to women is slightly more complicated than Pax Dickinson's.
I feel like this is where tech bros and bro bros really differ the most, right? Like, I feel like at least the traditional stereotype of like a bar bro is that he's like predatory towards women, and that when you put a bunch of them together in a group, they're like dangerously predatory towards women. But like tech bros, it really seems like, from the example of Pax Dickinson and also Brian Goldberg, who I think we'll talk about later, who is working on this startup magazine website for women, they seem to, yes, really just have no idea that women are a thing that should even be like in their worldview, like, because women don't like tech, apparently.
Women don't like tech.
Yeah.
I mean, he said this amazing thing. Tech, he said, I'd worry more about taking away what makes tech great. The freewheeling nature of it is what leads to innovation. So what he's saying, what you read between the lines there is the resistance to any kind of social engineering, right? Like any idea that you need to sort of put in programs to help women or anything like that. And I would say women in Silicon Valley say this same thing. So it's not just the men doing this. There's just this feeling in Silicon Valley that no matter what the woman problem is in the tech world, like the last thing you want to do is have some kind of HR policy to solve it, because that would like destroy all of innovation.
And
so that's how they've set it up. It's like women versus innovation.
And we should say that the Pax Dickinson story sort of broke a couple days after there was a story of a new app that was unveiled called TitStare, which I actually never fully clicked through to the stories to see what TitStare did, but I
Do
think...
Do you need to click
through? Right, exactly. Like, I think it sort of says it all in the title. And this generated a lot of furor online, you know, like, how could you think this was funny? Like,
It was presented at a whole conference,
right?
Like where people were presenting their
right.
amazing ideas to a mostly male audience.
Right.
That people have noted, like, it was presented because they thought it would get a huge laugh, and
right.
It did. It wasn't like anyone in the audience was like, stop it.
Right, and because of the internet, which is a thing that tech bros created a long time ago, everyone else got to see it and be unhappy about it. So it just sort of wasn't a great PR week for the tech world in general.
So can we excuse tech bros because they're juvenile? In other words, they don't actually seem like grown men. Like Brian Goldberg, who's made a lot of money.
No, we cannot excuse them. Hanna, don't be an apologist for tech bros.
I'm just asking. Like, they just seem like they're 14 years old. Like
exactly, like, and they're grown men.
They are. Like a whole like species that has grown up in the glow of the computer screen, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the theory, is that they've been immersed in this world for so long that really, honestly, like humanity is pretty alien to them, much less womanhood.
So I actually wrote a piece a couple weeks ago about how tech is the new Wall Street in terms of sort of pop culture villainry. Like, it sort of occupies the same mental space for some people now, that if you're looking for an easy rich guy villain who's wrapped up in his own wealth and sense of self-worth, a lot of times people are pulling an example out of the tech world instead of Wall Street. And those two worlds are similar in that they're mostly male environments. It's where people
make a lot of money at a very young age and live with a lot of people who are a lot like them. And that's sort of a recipe for sexism. And so you'll constantly see articles about sexism in Wall Street, and now you're seeing them about sexism in tech. And there's just a ton of parallels there.
So what do we do about something like this, right? It's like a serious problem that there's this tech industry, and the tech industry is the future of our world, and it like determines how we live, and women have a really hard time breaking into it. And also the women in tech. I mean, I remember reading a story about Sheryl Sandberg in which someone at the Facebook HR department said something like, you know, every second I spend worrying about sexism is another second I'm not worrying about Facebook's problems, right? Like, they're incredibly resistant to this idea. And Marissa Mayer says it too. Like, in that whole video that PBS did about the history of feminism, Marissa Mayer said, I'm not a feminist, and she got a lot of heat for that. But there's just a strong resistance to that baggage. Like, they think of it as baggage. Like, they think, you know, basically what you read from Pax Dickinson's Twitter feed is every time he gets an email about sexism in tech, you know, it's just like, wah, 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 wah. That's how he hears it. He doesn't want to hear anything about it or do anything about it. So what do? Like, he forces you into the position of being, like, the dour feminist who's forcing women. And, you know what I mean? It just sets it up. It's a setup.
And you want to say the answer is to shame the Pax Dickinsons of the world, right? But actually, he's probably gotten funding for his new app because now he's a name. And there, you know, there are a lot of people who have rushed to his defense. It was a woman who broke his Twitter feed, the news of it on Ballywag, and now, you know, the like libertarian forces in the tech world have mobilized to kind of ruin her Google search. Like, if she gets mean emails every day, you know, so people are backing up Pax Dickinson. So as much as, like, in this room, he's a villain, maybe other places he's an example of what happens when feminists start policing, you know, everything. Mm-hmm. I don't have a good answer.
I mean, it's interesting because tech is an industry that is actually uniquely suited to gender-blind hiring in a lot of ways, because you're usually, I mean, at least in coding and programming jobs, you are judging someone based on their code. At Slate, for example, we have developers on staff who were hired without ever having met our head of development in person, and in fact having only done coding tests over screen shares. So they're anonymous words on a screen over the course of that test. And it reminds me of like those old stories about it, when symphony orchestras do auditions with a player behind a screen, more women get jobs. And so there, it's not as though it's an environment that couldn't ever change. Part of the problem, of course, is that we live in a world in which from, you know, age 6 or 7, girls are sort of subtly or not so subtly steered away from math and science, and that's something that is slowly but definitively being remedied in many elementary schools, at least. But no, the long answer is I have no idea.
So you know, if you think of the world as your test case, like, is it true that women are inherently not drawn to math or not interested in it or not biologically suited for it or neurologically suited or however you want to put it, you can look around the world and say, are there countries in which there are a lot more women in tech? Well, there are. There are hardly any countries where there are as many women as men. There's like one. I had this conversation with someone in Silicon Valley. It's like Bulgaria. It's someplace in Eastern Europe. And then there are Asian countries in which, because there's a general bigger emphasis on math and science, like Korea, there are more women, but nowhere near 50%. So you feel like you could push the experiment somewhere, but not totally far.
And some of it's cultural. You know, there are more and more women in Silicon Valley, but they tend to be, and even women starting doing their own startups, but often they're fashion related, they're shopping related. And I think that's great, but like also it sort of silos you off into a certain corner of the startup world where you're talking mostly to women and about things that women tend to be more interested in. So I think, like, you know, sort of broadening what women are going for when they do go into that world, you know?
But what's wrong with that?
Like, no,
what's wrong with making a lot of money on like a social networking or a fashion site or whatever, if that's what you're interested in?
Nothing necessarily, but it doesn't serve any, like, if part of the idea is that we want to increase the footprint of women inside the tech industry, like sort of segregating them in their own specific region of the industry is not going to like solve that problem.
And frankly, within the Silicon Valley culture, my understanding is that is sort of not as sexy, right? Like, you made, like, Zappos was the big innovator in that space, and Amazon was a big innovator in that space, and your, like, cool boutique is online boutique, like, maybe it's not. And so they aren't going to respect you quite as much.
Well, there is the cult of the male genius, right, mm-hmm. in Silicon Valley that lives hard. Like, there's a guy, you know, we have a certain idea of what a Silicon Valley genius looks like. And it's really never a woman. I mean, a Silicon Valley genius is like an 18-year-old guy in a hoodie. You know?
Right, or it's Marissa Mayer, but she's not the genius. She's like
No one ever calls her that.
Right. She's like the hardworking, like, woman who broke through and served as an example to everyone else.
Exactly. She and Sheryl Sandberg are trotted out for all of these things. Like, we've done it probably a bajillion times on this podcast. You know, no, we probably have. We've definitely had segments on each of those women, but, like, you rarely hear beyond those two names, which is kind of awful.
So, like, it's not, I mean, is it crazy to just say that the answer is that they should just specifically hire a lot of women? Like, that they should just institute a policy? I mean, maybe it will never happen, but, like, if I was someone working in the tech world right now and I wanted to tap an unbelievably rich and untapped well of programmer talent, I would only hire women.
You would?
Right, well, just because...
Just to push the ball forward. So Google has done a few interesting things. The first thing Google did was they ran this A/B testing on hiring, and they had two forms of hiring. And then one, they would just put bullet point descriptions of a job. So they would put, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And what they noticed when they did that is that men and women would react to that list very differently. So a woman would look at the list and would be like, well, I'm not really qualified for 2 or 5, so I guess that job's not for me. And then the dudes would look at the list and say, like, I could do 3. I'm in. I
right.
could do number
I bet I
three,
could figure out the rest of that
6.
Shit. Right.
I could figure out the rest of that shit, exactly. Right. So they had totally different responses if you made a list. So what Google started to do is eliminate the list and just put a paragraph description. And they actually ran an official test, and it, like, upped the females applying for a job by, like, 40% or something. It made, like, a huge difference. Do you feel sad to be a woman now?
Yeah, yes. No, I was thinking about how I would have responded, and exactly in the stereotypical way, which is awful.
Right. And you're like, number 8, I can do 7, but I'm so bad at 8.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, me too. I would definitely look at that list and be like, oh, I got it.
I could do it.
No problem.
And the second thing they did, which is a story Marissa Mayer told me, was that, you know, they basically had some Pax Dickinson-like bro douche come through their interview process who would not take her seriously.
That was an editorial value judgment that we just threw in there.
Jerk. They come through the interview process, and he like, was very disrespectful to her when she was interviewing him. She was in charge of interviewing him. And she kind of sheepishly brought this up with the bosses at Google, and they said, well, we're just not going to hire that guy, and not only are we not going to hire that guy, we're going to have a woman sit in on every interview. And so they, you know, for a while, it was like, poor Marissa Mayer sitting in on every interview. She's like, the only woman.
Wait a minute. You're a woman. Could you sit in on every
exactly.
interview?
Right, and then they got her mom to sit in on interviews. No, eventually they hired more women.
That's great. That's, like, maybe my favorite thing I've heard about Marissa Mayer, actually.
Right.
I like that. Yeah.
So do we, before we pivot from the segment, do we want to talk about Brian Goldberg as a way of, like, making distinctions between bro? Like,
I mean, I just...
So that Pax Dickinson doesn't have to stand for every jerk in Silicon Valley.
I just love him
kinds.
So much. I just love... So the New Yorker has a profile this week by Lizzie Whitcomb of Brian Goldberg, who started this website several years ago with some other bros called Bleacher Report, which is like a semi-crappy but extremely financially successful sports website. And then he got out of it this winter and started raising funding for a new site, a site for women, which he and his staff, his all-female staff, of writers and editors, decided to call Bustle. And then
Bustle,
yes, Bustle.
With the idea that there are no sites for women out there, that this was untapped space.
Right, so that was the problem, was that, well, that was one of many problems, was that he then did this, like, big, like, blog post announcing its launch, and the blog post was essentially all about how he, Brian Goldberg, figured it out. Like, there had previously been no places for women who both want to read about politics and fashion, but now there is. Bustle.
It was so much worse than that. Like, he
it was
just
a
really,
it was an unbelievably
on
tone deaf and terrible blog post.
Like, I don't know the difference between mascara and eyeliner, but they do.
I hired these women, and they know it.
My favorite line was he was shocked that there would be women who were interested in fashion but not interior design. He just, like, his mind could not wrap itself around that idea.
And so he is who we talk about when we talk about like the tech bro who is like clearly just has no clue. And he like almost gleefully admits that he doesn't know anything about women at all. Like I almost expect him like at some point in this profile to be like, I'm a virgin. But like, so this profile by Lizzie Whitacombe, which by the way, includes, I would say, the cruelest physical description of a person in a New Yorker profile ever.
Yes.
Here it is. He is slightly plump, and he tends to wear baggy polo shirts, purchased in San Francisco, where, as he puts it, the schlubbier you are, the more credibility you have. With his puffy face and untrimmed hair, he resembles a giant six-year-old.
Wasn't the line before that, you expect him to be handsome, all right. But...
Despite having run a sports website, he does not look like an athlete.
Yes.
But so, you know, and so after the, you know, the incredible blowback against this terrible blog post of his, he wrote what I actually thought was an extremely sympathetic and credible apology. Like, it was not a, I'm sorry if you were offended apology. It was a, I am a moron and I blew it and I completely screwed over all the women who are working hard on my site and I'm really sorry.
That's crisis management. I don't know.
Crisis management is a shitty apology. At least it's good crisis management. Like, who even does that anymore?
I don't know. He's a 30-year-old man, and he's come to this place in his life with this... He's not a malevolent character at all.
No.
But it's, like, it's not even willful ignorance. Or maybe it is willful ignorance, but just, like, he's flaunting his ignorance about, like, just half of the human race. Like, as if it, you know... And he's investing in them. That's the crazy thing. He's, like... It's like he's discovered a new continent and he's going to mine it for gold or something.
Yeah, he said in the New Yorker profile, he described the magazine. I don't know why this struck me as funny because it's not that funny, but it's for modern women with busy lifestyles. I just feel like...
It's like Mad Libs. It's like feminist Mad Libs. Yeah, I know there was a scene in there... Right. And there was a scene in there where he's meeting with an investor and the investor says, you know, who's this for? And he says, modern women with, I think this is the same scene, modern women with busy lifestyles. And the guy goes, oh, so like Sheryl Sandberg's. And he goes, oh, no, not quite like that. And the guy's like, working moms. Like they just run through. And I guess we like are the people who we talk about, you know, modern women with busy lifestyles and Sheryl Sandberg and working moms. But there was something about hearing these businessmen parrot it back as like, commodities to be traded. Your busy lifestyle.
Like a yogurt commercial.
Yeah, exactly. Well, like a birth control commercial or something. Right.
Well, also the clear implication of that scene was that Brian Goldberg had never heard of Sheryl Sandberg in his life. Like that was obviously what Lizzie Whitacombe was trying to say, but the fact checkers wouldn't let her actually say that.
So the kicker of the piece. Should we talk about the kicker of the piece?
Can we please talk about the kicker of the piece?
Okay, we're going to embarrass Hannah here. So Dan has it in front of him.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to read the last paragraph.
So it's all about how, you know, he talks about how badly he handled everything and how it really hurt the site. And
I just want to put on the record, I don't want this segment to happen. It's
going to happen. We
don't have to do it. No, it's okay.
No, now we have to.
Listen, but I feel bad.
In the end, Goldberg decided the mistake of his launch announcement had been an audience problem. He'd aimed the announcement at venture investors and advertising executives, he said, but, quote, it reached an audience of writers, a group with different sensibilities. He told me that he wished he'd spent time building relationships with what he called the feminist community. It got me thinking, he said. Honestly, nothing would have been more helpful here than for some highly regarded feminist writers to say, Brian's a good person. So then...
The very day
that this article came out, Hannah Rosen gets an email.
From Brian
Goldberg saying,
subject
you're a highly
line,
regarded feminist writer.
Subject line, you're awesome.
But you know what? Like, I read the email and I just have one thing to say. Brian's a good person.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Let's move on.
I am awesome. All right. So, we're going to move on to our second topic, sexual assault in the military. But before we do that, I want to thank our sponsor, Audible.com, our loyal sponsor. Audible offers 100,000 audiobooks as well as almost any form of enlightened chatter available on the internet. You can listen to them on practically any device, including the one you're using to listen to us right now. And I will tell you, I listen to Audible all the time because we're always doing long car rides, including the one we did to our retreat this weekend. For XX listeners who are not Audible members, they offer a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at our special URL, audiblepodcast.com/XX, not XX, but XX. Our book this week, this was a recommendation from Dan Coyce, Bleeding Edge by Thomas Pynchon, post-apocalyptic satire about Silicon Valley in which Pax Dickinson has been eviscerated, blown up.
No, in spirit.
In spirit.
Yeah.
Read by the amazing Jeannie Berlin, who's a wonderful actress, so you should check that out. And your membership also includes a free subscription to either the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, so give it a try, audiblepodcast.com/XX. Okay. Let's move on to bro institution number two. There seems to be a theme in this podcast that does or does not need reforming. A couple of months ago, the Pentagon released a report saying that sexual assaults had jumped from 19,000 to 26,000, and this was just a couple of weeks after the Air Force officer in charge of sex assault prevention was arrested for battery. That was a great moment.
That was a fine moment,
really,
yeah, in America.
Now there is a heated debate following that in the Senate Armed Services Committee about how exactly to deal with this problem. Senator Claire McCaskill says that we should do it through the chain of command, that we should do it basically the way we do it now with a few changes, but keep it within the military. Her bill has support, of course, from the military brass, and it has passed the Senate Armed Services Committee. We have opposing her, or not opposing her, but an alternative vision from Senator Kristen Gillibrand saying we need a bigger overhaul, take it outside the military, and have independent prosecutors deal with cases of rape. So I'll start with you, Noreen. Are you on Team Gillibrand or Team McCaskill? Do you think it's something you can deal with internally or something that you have to take outside the military?
So as much as I am generally a fan of Claire McCaskill, I'm on Team Gillibrand this time. There are a number of countries that have recently decided to have sexual assaults in the military be prosecuted in the normal court system. And in those countries, including Israel and Britain, so allies of the United States, like developed, respected armies, those programs are considered a success, I think, by people within the military, by people outside of the military in those countries. But what has happened in those countries is that reported sexual assaults have gone up by 80%, which means that people are no longer afraid to report their sexual assaults. It also means bad PR for those countries. So the United States military does not want this PR right now. They don't want that number to be there. But it seems pretty clear to me, I mean, I'm not in the military, but if I were a woman who was given a choice of, you know, reporting within this closed system or reporting to someone with actual, where I knew that it would be prosecuted through the fullest extent of the law without, you know, someone who had ties to this guy who'd been in his unit, just someone coming in from the outside, I think I'd want that route. I think that would make me more comfortable reporting it. The other side of it is that you might not be comfortable making the consequences so rough for someone who, you know, is like your comrade in arms, someone who you've gone through all this with.
You know, if you read the stories about the military, what happens in the military, they are totally indistinguishable from college stories.
Mm-hmm.
So they always involve hazing, for example. They involve a huge amount of drinking. They involve sort of, you know, non-consent, basically. Someone gets drunk, you know, they go on a date, there's sort of, you know, someone puts pressure on her, she doesn't exactly consent, but she's too drunk to not consent, and then the woman wakes up the next morning. I mean, they're so similar to college stories that you have to think, like, the structure is exactly the same. It's like colleges deal with this all the time, where we're suspicious of colleges that want to keep their reporting internal, because we feel like, oh, you just don't want, you know, X college, you know, Yale.
Right.
And
or UNC,
George Mason,
for example.
UF, whatever, to like get the bad press. But maybe for the women, like the whole process of going to an outside prosecutor makes it just such a huge big deal. So I'm not sure.
Yeah, and colleges are doing that increasingly. And you can see arguments on both sides. I mean, I think it's not a perfect analogy, right? Because college and the military are, at most schools, tend to be very different cultures. I think another maybe useful analogy when you're thinking about sexual assault in the military is that it is a somewhat closed universe where people have a lot of loyalty to each other. It's an us against the rest of the world kind of mentality, and that like it needs it to survive. And so if you look at a lot of small religious communities, there's also a lot of sexual assault in Hasidic Jewish communities or Amish communities, and you just see it over and over again because people don't want to report it, and you know the internal justice system in all of those places is flawed. And you could argue that the U.S. military has a much more sophisticated system for dealing with that, but it clearly isn't working.
Which just reminds me, I mean, more than anything else, it reminds me of like sports teams, right? Like a football team. There's no way that if
you're such a dude.
Yeah. I'm a bro. On a football team, if like one of the players was accused of sexual assault by someone, you would not then go to the coach and be like, okay, you are in charge of investigating and prosecuting whether this player sexually assaulted someone at a bar after the game. Because there are clear lines of loyalty and connection between the coach and the player. And it's even more convoluted in the military because there are also clear lines of connection between the commander, potentially the accused sexual assaulter, and the victim. Like, all three of those people are all caught up in the same web, and there are so many conflicting loyalties that are so hard to parse that it seems to me like a no-brainer that you would just get this out of the system completely and take it somewhere else for someone who can just look at it independently and deal with it. And now Claire McCaskill's argument against that is that, hold on, I'm looking at an op-ed that she did for USA Today, but so they, she says that in the past 2 years, we found 93 cases of rape and sexual assault that prosecutors declined to prosecute, which were then nevertheless referred to court-martial by commanders. That's 93 victims who had their day in court because commanders, not prosecutors, had the ability to refer cases for court-martial. So their argument is that there are cases in which commanders, presumably because of their, you know, honor or integrity or whatever, they feel like they're more likely to take these cases and pursue justice. And, you know, I don't know. I have no idea what is actually right or correct in this case, but it just seems crazy to me to think that you would prosecute this inside the system with people who have these ties, as you say, these ties of extreme loyalty to each other.
Right. And also, I mean, some of this changing the consequences is about changing the culture, which is a much bigger problem. But if you just start to think of it as a universe that is attached to another, you know, like it's not its own thing, it's part of America's justice system, I think that might make people just approach this differently. You know, like if it's something that has consequences beyond your platoon, you're going to think about that a little harder, hopefully.
I also think those two issues are getting conflated in this debate. So there's, you know, there's clear sexual assault and rape, which have legal standards. They're actually very hard to prosecute in the regular world.
Right.
So it's not like
right.
Suddenly there would be tons of rapes prosecuted. It's very difficult for many reasons to prosecute rape cases. And then there's the separate question of the military culture, which I think the background of this, which we haven't mentioned yet, is women in combat. And, you know, the increasing acceptance of women in combat and this idea that kind of the women are coming to get us and this is a man's institution. It's, you know, the analogy I think of is like firemen, you know, like what happened when they started letting women be fire women, how do you say that? Women be
fire ladies.
Fire ladies.
Ladies of fire.
That hasn't changed. We still totally say firemen.
Uh-huh. But what happened when they started letting women be fire women?
There was a huge amount of resistance, and there were lawsuits which went up to the Supreme Court, and they basically said, look, you set a steady standard. It's like exactly what happens in combat. If the woman can meet that standard, then all your other arguments don't hold water. So, like, you set the weight standard at a certain amount. They have to pass certain physical requirements, and that's too bad. Like, women can be eligible for the job. So you can guess what the firemen did. They just raised the physical requirements to make them harder, and, you know, certain number of women still pass those requirements. Now, if you look at your average firehouse, there's not that many women around. So it's not, you know, the culture was not fundamentally changed. There are not a ton of women who want to be firemen. I don't know why it hasn't changed, but...
Well, the nature of fighting is changing, though, right? So I'm not an expert in this, but the way we do war now, you can. I went to high school with someone. He played a lot of video games in high school, and now he sits in a military center in Colorado and
plays a lot of video games.
Plays a lot of video games, except with people's lives, you know. And so you don't need to be able to do as many push-ups to do that. I mean, there are still, obviously, physical standards in the military. That's not going to go anywhere, and there is still going to be, you know, boots-on-the-ground combat. But I see the cultural argument as resembling when African-Americans entered the military. They were sort of like, you know, this is going to disrupt our fraternity here. You know, they're not like us. And I think that's really what we're dealing with now. It's not quite as much the physical thing as it was when women wanted to be firefighters. That's what the term we're looking for.
Of course, firefighters, easy one.
I'm so interested in like in what it's like in those bunkers in Colorado. I guess that's sort of where like tech bros and army bros intersect. Like, are there more women in those positions than in other combat positions in the military, or are those just attracting tech bros who want to play video games?
Video game bros. Different kind of bro. We've identified a lot of bros.
Today
species.
Is the taxonomy of bros.
I mean, we've talked about this in our Women in Combat segments on the podcast before, but it largely has to do with, you know, women were brought along during ostensible nation-building exercises, which sort of crossed boundaries with fighting wars. And so they were brought along under a different rubric, and they ended up putting their lives in danger, but yet they somehow didn't count as being in combat roles. And so so part of the argument for including them was like, we're just recognizing an existing reality. You know, it's not so much about being in combat as there are women in supply units and women out there doing many things and getting killed for those doing those many things but not being recognized for it. So I don't know about the tech bros, but it was just recognizing an existing reality. So you feel like the more years that women and men are in units together, sort of the more they come to depend on each other and the resistance goes away.
Right. Time heals all wounds.
I was really fascinated by this. I mean, there's a Salon piece that I was looking at about this by Alex Seitz-Wald, which is making the comparison with the lift of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that a lot of the impetus, a lot for lifting Don't Ask, Don't Tell came not only from inside of America, but from the fact that other nations with armies, you know, to whom we were allied, lifted their, or never had those restrictions, but lifted those restrictions and saw that, it didn't tear apart their militaries. Right. They were still able to survive. And so it seems like the direction that this is probably taking is to follow the actions of our allies who have successfully instituted this policy of prosecuting this outside the chain of command in a similar way. But but every time we talk about this, all I can flash back on is that amazing hearing in front of the Senate in which, you know, like the 25 general dudes like sat in a row in their uniforms to talk about, and they were all guys, to talk about the problem of sexual assault in the military. And it was like the worst optics in the history of anything. Like, it seems hard to change that kind of institution.
So now they just let two women on the Senate Armed Services Committee fight about it.
Right.
Right.
Well, you have a whole theory, right, about women being put in I don't want to make you talk about this theory, but the idea that they do want women to talk about military actions is sort of strategic, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, this theory grew out of my the idea that when a couple of weeks ago we thought that we were going to do something about Syria as opposed to be in this holding pattern that we're in now, that they made the public face of the interventionist argument women. So you had, you know, Samantha Power, Hillary Clinton, and Susan Rice. And Susan Rice particularly, she would give talks where she would say that this is about being a mother. I can't stand to see those women and children, you know, being subject to chemical attacks. So it was essentially like sort of a maternal argument for intervention. That was the approach that the administration was taking at some point, which was interesting. I mean, many years ago, I don't mean this to be as sort of politically nasty as it's going to sound. So excuse this analogy, but many years ago, I remember when tobacco companies and gun companies started to hire attractive women. They sort of fired all the kind of guys who were their lobbyists in Washington and hired women because they felt like they needed a sort of, you know, softer, gentler face for lung cancer. And so there was a little echo of that for me when the Obama administration sort of essentially put up these three women to make the case for intervention. The softer side of bombing and the softer side of dressing. How about that?
Crush it.
our next topic is going to be pajama chic. The trend of wearing pajamas in public has been building for the last few years and recently reached its apex on the runways, where designers presented not pajama-inspired fashions, but full-on pajamas. just so that it's not just women embarrassing themselves, we'll rest on the... There's dudes. Yes, that dude. He will be your fashion role model.
That's...
So should we describe it a little bit?
Yeah, sorry.
Listeners?
So for our listening audience, this is really cruel what I'm doing. I'm showing a slideshow of the runway season in which you see people in silk pajamas, like short ones, long ones, but they're really full-on pajama ensembles. Very chic, very chic. And as always, teenagers and college kids are ahead on this front and have already mastered the I just rolled out of bed look. And their parents' generation has already provoked a backlash. This is a quote from a Louisiana commissioner who said he tried to outlaw pajamas, the wearing of pajamas in public, and he said, the moral fiber in America is dwindling away. It's pajamas today. What is it going to be tomorrow? Walking around in your underwear? But then, our own tech columnists and other people who defend the pajama trend, in this case, it's the Slate's tech columnist, wrote, I contend that we'd all be better off, more comfortable, less anxious, substantially happier, and did I mention more comfortable, if adults habitually wore pajamas outside during the day. So, on our podcast before this live show, we had an argument. I suggested we wear pajamas on stage. I got a resounding yes and a resounding no. You go first. You're the yes man. Why did you agree that it would be okay to wear pajamas on stage in front of this respectable audience?
Because I wanted to highlight the idiocy of wearing pajamas in public by showing how moronic we would look attempting to be like adults who people had paid money to see but yet could not even dress ourselves.
Noreen, respectable woman that you are, you said,
I said
hell no.
I said no. And I should say that I have worn pajamas in public, okay? I'm of the generation that I don't know if I wore pajamas to class ever, but in college, and actually, frankly, for about a year afterwards, I would just run to the grocery store and some boxers and a sweatshirt. You know, it just didn't seem like a big deal. But I also think that clothing dictates your self-presentation, and I would be slouching on this stage. I would be like not sitting like a lady. I just would not be feeling very professional, and I don't think that I would have presented very professionally. And you know, you guys paid good money to see us, as Dan Quist just said. I did not want to. And okay, also to be honest, my pajamas aren't that nice. they're kind of.
I was, in all honesty, going to borrow pajamas from a friend of mine who has really nice pajamas.
Yeah, I don't have like beautiful silk pajamas, you know?
But I have amazing pajamas, but I'm not going to wear them in the world. Like, who would do that?
You know, I went back. There was a year when I was working at the Washington Post where a wonderful fashion writer named Robin Givhan won the Pulitzer for her fashion coverage, and it was particularly for a story she wrote about Dick Cheney, who showed up at an Auschwitz swearing-in ceremony wearing a parka, like a big hoodie parka. Like, everybody else was in a black suit and a really nice woolen coat, and he was sitting there in his parka. And it was just like you said, Noreen, he was like this, down on the stage, and everybody else was like, you know, sitting up with the formality of the occasion, and Robin Givhan just kind of ripped him a new one
for showing up
in the parka. And her good line was, but sometimes out of respect for the occasion, one must endure a little discomfort. And so, you know, it seemed like a sort of lesson for daily life. It's not all about being comfortable. But I'm actually going to take the pro pajama side
of
the two of you, because I feel like, you know, as a person with three children who often works in my attic, I have to actually actively get dressed in order to take my children to school or do anything outside. And it's like, why can't I just go out in my pajamas and not only do that, but it be cool? Like, I deserve to be on a runway.
You can't have it all.
Go out in your pajamas if you want, but don't expect us to, condone it.
Yeah, because suddenly it's like the things that moms do, oh, she's really gone to seed. Look at her picking up her kids. It's so cool now. Like, I haven't gone to seed. I'm like the pinnacle of high fashion.
I hope that soon on the runways, they're like, it'll be like women with their hair in rollers.
Right.
So
exactly.
Then you can go out to the bus stop like that.
Exactly.
So I have a job where I can totally, if I want to, work at home. And I go into the office almost every day, like, basically because it forces me to get out of my pajamas. I just think it's like a good thing for your mental health to put on clothing almost every other day.
Almost every other day. So I recall, you know, having gone to college in the era when people wore actually clothes to class, I remember driving onto a college campus one time, this was about 8 years ago, and being shocked at how college students dress. Like, I'm not that much of a fuddy-duddy, but just like, you know, with their, like, just sweat, like, just looking terrible, right?
Sweatpants
like,
all the time.
Sweatpants yes. all the time. Like, everybody on campus was wearing sweatpants. So what happened culturally between the era when people wore clothing to class and the era when it became okay to look like you just rolled out of bed? Like, is that a sign of disrespect, a sign of entitlement? Like, now I know I'm like the mom person talking, but okay, fine, whatever. Like, what is it about, what is it about youth today that they feel it's okay to wear ratty sweatpants
to class? Okay, so I think Dan's generation really bridged the gap here. I mean, I think
that's true, we did.
And then, no, but like, what was cool to wear in the 90s, like baggy clothes, sports jerseys, like everything just got increasingly more casual.
I went on many days when I was in college, I would wear a flannel shirt over another flannel shirt.
There you go.
Like, that was an outfit.
That was an outfit. No, you put some thought into that.
Yeah, and it like sent a very specific message to my professors, which is like, this guy is a joker.
When I was in high school, J-Lo wore these velour tracksuits or sweatsuits or something. Do you guys remember those? Anyway, I had the Juicy Couture, yeah. And so this is appalling. I had a purple one in high school, and we would like wear it to class and think it looked cool. I mean, so the 90s happened basically. And then if you've gone down that road, then, you know, 2 years later in college, it seems fine to roll out of bed and put on some sweatpants and like a hoodie and go to class.
Right, but there's an affirmative. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, okay, I have some.
And then I'm going to yell at you.
Okay, I think that time of day matters. I think like if it's a pre-noon class, then it's okay. I think if you.
Well, because you can't be bothered to like put on why?
Yeah.
We should just be grateful you showed up.
Yeah, exactly. That's the message. It's like you should be right.
Okay. All right. And then if it's after, let's say 11 p.m. and you're going to the grocery store, I think that's fine. I also think, and this is going to be controversial, maybe I think age makes a difference. So the year after college, I moved to a neighborhood in New York that's near a college. And I surrounded by a lot of college students, and we sort of treated it like a campus, right? Like we would run out to the grocery store all the time in our, you know, essentially like pajamas, boxers, and hoodies. And I remember one night I was cooking dinner and I wanted to get some wine for dinner. I went to the liquor store at the end of our street wearing that. And there's this woman coming down the street, and she, you know, she was like an older New York City woman who didn't look all there, and she was wearing slippers and her nightgown and a bathrobe, and she was just shuffling towards the liquor store, and I was like, that is so sad. Like, I'm so sorry for that. Like, and then I paused, and I was like, I am doing the exact same thing. I'm just not wearing a nightgown, but I just left my house to go to the liquor store.
Oh my God, that is so not fair. You have nothing to do but get dressed in the morning. I have to, like, get three people dressed and make them lunch, and I'm sad if I were with the most...
Uh-huh. It's tough. It's tough, Anna. All right, Ted, are you against me, Dan?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm basically outraged by everything you said. So,
I would just like to say Carmela Soprano. So she, you know, she's your counterpoint there.
All right.
Okay. Well, first of all, there's an affirmative difference, but even between a purple Juicy Couture tracksuit and, like, shitty sweatpants... In class. So I have, we are here at George Mason University on their Arlington campus. I have, in fact, taught classes as an adjunct at George Mason University on their Fairfax campus. And I have a very distinct memory of the first day of class when literally every single one of my students looked like a hobo. Like they all looked, every woman was dressed in sweatpants or boxers and like a terrible t-shirt and like no one had done anything with their hair, and every single guy was wearing Adidas shower shoes. Every single one of them.
What time of day was this class?
It was from 7:20 till 10 p.m.
So it does not really fall into the Norwegian.
No, it does not. They had dressed to run out to the grocery store,
right.
Except for that then they came to my class. And they all looked like morons. Like, and they weren't morons, hardly any of them. And so it was very frustrating to me for them to self-present in such a way that I instantly, as apparently a 37-year-old fuddy-duddy...
Yeah, you're getting old, was, Dan. I know. What? Come on.
Right, but so, like, I guess I just thought, like, this is a learning environment in which we are all trying to be at our best, and surely that could extend to, like, putting on pants.
Did you treat them different? Did you feel about them like they're not going to be smart because they were the way they were dressed? Like, did it actually affect your...
Not,
view of them?
Not in any legally binding kind of way.
No. Okay, so I think pajama wearing in public is so deeply American, though. Like, you would never really see this in another country. And so I want to talk for a minute about the high fashion pajama wearing. There's a certain kind of really well-dressed woman. She looks purposefully undone, right? And I think that is taking that to the extreme, right? So if you want to be, like, super, super casual, like, you just don't care... There's a great picture of Marc Jacobs floating around the internet, and he's wearing, like, this big chinchilla fur coat, I think, and, like, loud pajamas, and he's stepping out of a town car, and somehow he looks glamorous because he can't be bothered to put on clothing. And there's something about just not caring. And this is almost a parody of not caring, right? Like, you're right. Too cool to get dressed. Like, right. You're going to get dressed when it matters, but it's not for Dan Coyce's class. Yes.
Well, and so the tradition, I mean, high fashion, some of the first designers who have done it have said, oh, well, yes, we based it on Julian Schnabel, who, of course, is the artist who is so schnobbly that he can't be bothered to ever wear pants. He just wears pajamas all the time at, like, cocktail parties because he doesn't give a fuck. But anyway, but so, like... I guess I appreciate that is a haute couture inspiration, like that is the inspiration for it, but like I don't know that is necessarily like the universe I want to live in which like the state of not caring because you're so rich you don't have to is like celebrated.
But can I bring in a little, this is like a white entitlement to thing, right? Huh. Like somebody came, David Plotz, my husband, who's the editor of Slate.
Somebody.
There's a special name for him.
What? What? Yeah, I have this paranoia working at Slate that because I'm David's wife, nobody tells me anything. No, so this is one of those moments. Anyway, so David comes to the office. He wears his sneakers and he wears his T-shirts and his, you know, jeans are slouching, whatever. He doesn't dress every day unless he has a meeting. And Donna Byrd over at The Root, which is, you know, the black site that's connected to Slate, said, you know, David, like if a black man dressed like you to work every day, like they wouldn't necessarily let him in the office. He definitely wouldn't be the editor. So you wonder if, like, this is just, like, I am such a... Because it is the tech bros that push this one step further, right? Like, where it became the more money you have, the more hoodies you have. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you're Mark Zuckerberg, you can wear your hoodie to a hedge fund meeting.
He wore Adidas shower shoes to a hedge fund
meeting. There you go.
Also, I know someone who lived on his freshman floor, famous pajama wearer in public. True story. Like, he was known, for two things in college, apparently, like, Facebook and pajamas. Like, those were his things. And he's arguably, like, sort of the defining figure of this generation.
I feel like we're making an argument for... Now it's, like, more pajamas, more money. So everyone's going to want to wear pajamas in public.
I actually hate the high fashion pajama look. I think it's, like, anti-sexy. Like, I guess you're evoking bed or whatever, but, like, not in, like, a lingerie way. It's like, no, these are my, like, comfy pajamas. I'm going to go to sleep, like, right now, you know?
Right. And that's like liberating for women? Shouldn't we consider this, like, a sign of feminist liberation that we
that's
can wear
so
pajamas?
That's so second wave.
It's so second wave.
Maybe that's fourth or fifth. I don't know.
Like, I guess people, there was a feminist, the second wave did wear overalls, right?
So right, okay.
It's just another iteration of the overall.
It doesn't seem to mean to evoke sexiness at all. Like, it seems to mean to evoke pure comfort. Like, that's the idea of it. And that way, it is, like, quietly revolutionary for fashion, which has never really cared about comfort even a tiny bit. Like, it's been aggressively anti-comfort in many ways.
I think it's comedic looking. Like, I just
well,
think
these guys, yeah, look
right,
at them.
But, like, picture...
Well, but wait, for our listeners, we will post this on our Facebook.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
It's
yeah.
the
yeah.
picture of the three vampires in pajamas.
So, it really is. I just invented a new game for yourself. You know, when you're in front of an audience, you're supposed to, you know, to calm your nerves, you're supposed to picture them naked. Now I'm going to picture the audience in their pajamas all the time because I think that's actually funnier.
And all the men, I'm going to picture them with that bonnet.
I think it's a bustle.
Bustle tied around their heads. Okay, that's enough on pajamas. Let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, how about you go first, Madation?
I recently read a book by an author, Dawn Powell, who's sort of a forgotten gem of the earlier 20th century. It's called A Time to Be Born, and she's from Ohio, as am I, and she moved to New York, as did I. And it's just very funny and sharp, and it's sort of a romance, but it's like with a sardonic, really gimlet eye to it. It's supposedly based on Claire Booth Luce, so she's this social climbery wife of a newspaperman, set during the earliest 20th century, and I can't recommend it highly enough. It's a lot of fun.
Excellent. I'm going to recommend a New Yorker story I read recently about the Truman Show delusion, which I just found so interesting. It's by Andrew Marantz, and basically the story is about how schizophrenics who in other eras would imagine that they were being followed by someone in the CIA or the FBI now imagine that their life is a constant reality show. And it's a very meta story about the state of reality TV and what it's doing to us and the way that sort of works its way into the mind of a schizophrenic and just how exhausting it is, and it makes you feel like the world we live in of reality TV is exhausting. So it was really excellent on many levels.
But so in the London Review of Books this week, Jenny Diskey has this amazing piece defending a British reality / pop / tabloid star who is apparently just widely hated for being so shallow and terrible in Britain. But Jenny Diskey, who's a really fantastic literary critic in general, wrote this wonderful piece, which is like the prototype for how to do a Slate pitch, basically, even though it wasn't for Slate. But it was the prototype of how to take a counter position to the conventional wisdom and to argue it with such passion and logic that by the end of the piece, it is functionally impossible to not think that this woman, in fact, even though you previously thought she was a shallow nothing, is in fact an interesting piece of evidence for modern culture and has things worth saying that we should pay attention to.
Without doing it seeming to just be arguing for the sake of
argument. No, because she makes very specific personal connections to the work. I mean, it's, you know, you can't even, like, in a way that makes you think of this woman's life and career as a work, as opposed to just her being a shallow, like, crazy bimbo. And it's a fascinating piece and one of the best written things I've read in a really long time, and I highly recommend it.
That sounds great. Well, I would like to thank a lot of people for making this podcast possible, particularly Elizabeth Mount, who planted the idea for it.
Big hand for Elizabeth Mount.
Study of Gender and Conflict. I'd like to thank Aaron Bergen for setting up all of our events, for Mike Volo for coming and engineering the podcast, for Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts, and I'd love to thank our audience. Thank you for coming today. It's been great to do this in front of a live audience. Woo! As always, for our listeners, please come on our Facebook page and let us know what you'd like to talk about in a couple of weeks. For Dan and Maureen, I'm Connor Rosen, and we'll talk to you again in 2 weeks.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.